Good morning.
Good morning.
Well, it's good to see you.
Thank you.
And Janina. So, this morning I would like to talk about the Bodhisattva vow, Bodhisattva precepts. And the ceremony called Jikai. That's the. It's. I'm drawing a blank. It's a Jukai Tokudo for priest ordination. It's Jukai is something else for lay ordination. I can't remember what. But Jukai is. The precepts. Tokudo is leaving home. So, receiving the precepts or taking the precepts. So I want to talk about that. But I also want to talk about Jesus. I really love talking about Jesus. Jesus is a really cool bodhisattva. Neem Karoli Baba, a teacher for Ram Dass, Krishna Dass, Joseph Goldstein, I think, was with him for a while, if I'm not mistaken. Number of Dharma teachers and other spiritual teachers studied with this apparently amazing person, Neem Karoli Baba. And a student once asked Neem Karoli Baba what he thought of Jesus. And he just started to weep. So I think we need to recognize Jesus for who he is, and even though he's been expropriated by people who don't understand him a lot of the time. So that's a little preface to what I want to say. Jesus talked much about the kingdom of God. That was his main shtick. You know, the kingdom of God, proclaiming the kingdom of God. And a lot of the kingdom of God is like this, like, you know, that God is like a jewel, a pearl, a treasure hidden in a field. Pearl of great price, you know, all these metaphors. And the kingdom of God is at hand, he said. The kingdom of God is within you, he also said. So I am pretty sure he was not talking about some other place where you get pie in the sky by and by when you die. He wasn't talking about an afterlife. He was talking about a way of being right here, right now, a way of being. That is our true nature, that we have become estranged from. We have become prodigal towards. And he's got this parable, the prodigal son, the being who is estranged from the kingdom. And so a particular statement that I want to look at to preface my talk about the precepts is, after he had some seasoned disciples, he gathered them together and he says, "Behold, I send you forth as sheep among wolves. Be you therefore as cunning as serpents and as harmless as doves." So these disciples he's about to send out to proclaim the kingdom, they've been living in the kingdom for a while. They've been living in a place where there were no wolves, because they were in the presence of Jesus, who was manifesting the kingdom for them. So, but now he's sending them out, away from the kingdom, amongst people who may have no faith in the proclamation of the kingdom, who may be averse to it, who may be enraged by it, who may actually persecute them and put them to death because of it, in which in fact they did. And so his statement, "Behold, now I'm sending you out as sheep among wolves." You know, you're going to be among people who do not acknowledge the kingdom. Therefore, be as cunning as serpents. And I think he's making a reference back to the Garden of Eden, ironically. Be as cunning as the serpent was in the garden, who tricked Eve into eating the apple. You know. Use your wits. Don't be afraid to use your wits, but be as harmless as doves. I've been thinking about this statement of Jesus the last few weeks because I've had a hellish last few weeks. If many of you recall, like a year ago, I was going through a whole lot of stress because of a personnel issue. A member of the community who was enraged, felt mistreated, and was trying to do harm to the organization. Well, something quite similar is happening again. And it made me long for the kingdom. It made me long for Sangha. So, the nearest thing that I have experienced to what might be meant by what Jesus meant by the kingdom of God is Tassajara. Tassajara is a place where people are aspiring to live in the kingdom. In other words, they are aspiring to fulfill the Bodhisattva way. And I want to look at that through one particular precept, at least initially, and see where that goes, and that's the precept about anger. Two translations of that which come to mind are: a disciple of Buddha does not give rise to anger. I think that was the first way I heard it. And that's kind of problematic. The other way in which I heard it is a disciple of Buddha does not harbor ill will. That's more useful. Does not harbor ill will. In other words, sure, we're going to get irritated. Sure, we're going to feel hurt. Sure, we're going to feel offense. We're going to feel shame. We're going to feel various afflicted mental states. But we don't create a cozy little harbor for them and nurture them, nurture our grudges, and seek to retaliate. Now, when I think of the Gospels and I think of the features of the kingdom, non-retaliation is pretty big. You know. Love your enemies. Be kind to those who persecute you. Turn the other cheek. So non-retaliation is pretty big in the kingdom. And forgiveness is pretty big in the kingdom. You know, how many times should you forgive your brother? 70 times 7. And, you know, I think he's saying forever. Because, you know, if you start trying to tally it, pretty soon you feel how stupid you're being. You say, well, I just forgive, carte blanche, you know, get it over with, you know. So I don't think he's saying that you tally and then you wait for when you've done your 70 times 7 and then you can cut loose. I think if you try that, you'll learn. And you'll drop grudges, you'll drop resentment. And so those are two big features in the kingdom, and those are two big features in the precepts. So these last few weeks, missing the kingdom. I felt like I've been thrown as a sheep among wolves, and I don't have, and I you know, in all humility, I think I have some traction on harmless stuff. And I think I'm doing fairly well with that. But cunning as a serpent, I think I've got a ways to go. So that's what has caused me to reflect on what it's like to not be a sheep among wolves, what it's like to be in a practice container where everyone is committed to the kingdom, where everyone is committed to the precepts and to the vow. Where, sure, we'll get angry at each other, but non-harming is so fundamental that we feel ourselves stuck and we long to be unstuck. And so we do the difficult work of forgiveness, of understanding, and we don't want the sun to set on our wrath, as it says in the Bible. We want to work towards resolution, towards reconciliation. And the work is done there. And we can learn to be vulnerable, express our vulnerability, and we can learn to stay open. And I kind of wish that I had the appreciation for the Sangha jewel then, when I was living monastically, that I have now. Yeah, you don't know what you got until it's gone. And when I go back to Tassajara, you know, I am so moved. You know, people bowing to each other. And the gentle, open feeling I get from these young people that are there, taking up the practice, doing the practice for 3-4 years, and I can see how open they are. And I can see how hard it is to stay open among wolves. So I've been, so the koan for me is how to be as cunning as a serpent. What does that mean? You know, in the Oxford pictures, the last picture is the person who has realized, trained the ox, hopped on the ox, taken the ox for a ride, realized emptiness. That's not the conclusion. The conclusion is going back down to the marketplace with bliss bestowing hands. And they have the capacity to do that now. And so, and another thing that I wanted to say that's related to this, the ox herding pictures, and the fact that that circle of emptiness where the ox and the rider disappear, that's not the conclusion, is that this work is the work where we stay vulnerable, we stay human, we are honest about how we can, you know, we're human beings, so we can be hurt, we can feel offended, we can feel betrayed, mistreated. But we know of and long to dwell in a place that is not beyond that, but surrounding that with light and with gentleness and with understanding. Emptiness is important. But if we linger there, if we camp out there, if we try to create a way of being in the world where we're unaffected by what's outside, we cannot be moved, we don't get irritated, we're too enlightened for that. That's called a cave of emptiness, being caught in the cave of emptiness. And I've encountered students who've been caught there. Oh God, they're irritating, you know, because they're so aloof and they're so wise and they're so, you know, and you just can't, nothing you say gets to them. And they're of no use to the world. They've reneged on the vow of the Bodhisattva to stay in the world for the benefit of beings. And they found this nice, comfortable cave where they're unaffected. And that's why that ox herding picture, where we have some sense of emptiness, of that space of freedom, is not the place to stay. It's marching back into the world, warts and all, nerves as raw as they might be, as vulnerable as human beings can be, more vulnerable than the average human being, in fact, I would proffer. Because with intention we're vulnerable, with vow we're vulnerable. We walk into the world wanting to dance with all of the kleshas, with all of the afflictions, with all of the pain of the world, not to shield ourselves from it, but to learn how to move freely with it. Not an easy thing to do. How how to be as cunning as a serpent so that you can remain harmless as a dove among wolves. What does that look like? It's not treacherous stratagems, I don't think. I don't think that would actually do the trick. Because we have to be naive in a sense. We have to be genuine and transparent. We can't be covert, or we violate our own heart as well as our vow to be honest with other beings. I've been thinking about it in terms of emptiness in a sense. I think emptiness has a lot to do with it. In this way, there were two brother monks, and in our scriptures, in our koan collections, brother monks, and forgive me, it is almost always brother monks. It's kind of patriarchal, so there's one or two or three stories where there's a woman involved, but there's hundreds of stories where it's just guys. It's a kind of men's club. So please forgive us for that. Forgive the tradition for that. We're trying to correct that, even now. But when you read about these stories between two brother monks, it looks like they're always poking at each other. And I think it's important to remember that what they are doing is they're helping one another deepen their understanding, deepen their capacity to dwell in the world according to vow, according to intention, according to their commitments. It's not just a kind of like one-upmanship. You know, I gotcha! It's not that kind of thing. It's, you know, how do we clarify this jewel of the Dharma, of the way? So these two brother monks, Dao Wu and Yan Yan, Yan Yan was sweeping the ground. Dao Wu comes up to him and says, "Too busy. Too much noise in your mind. You're not focused. You have no samadhi with your brushing the ground, sweeping the ground. I can see that. I can feel that." Well, Yan Yan doesn't argue with him. You know, it's probably true. You know, he's not you know, denying it. Rather, he says, "You should know there is one who is not busy." Yeah, you're right. You know, my mind's elsewhere, but still, there is one who is not busy. Well, in that case, there's a second moon. And in this context, in many contexts, the moon means reality itself. Enlightenment is, it also means, but in this context more specifically, I think it refers to this. Oh, in that case, there's two realities. There's a dualism happening here. And so, Yan Yan picks up the broom and says, "Which moon is this? There's only one reality. This reality is one where, yeah, my mind is on what we're going to have for dinner tonight instead of the floor that I'm sweeping. But that's the reality." And then in the commentary, and I have to reconstruct it from memory because it just occurred to me on my drive up here to refer to it. Good students of the way, as you boil tea, cook rice, mend your clothes, go through your various daily tasks, you should see the one who is not busy. This is called simultaneous inclusion. Naturally not wasting any time. Something like that. So the one who is not busy, very, very important. And what sanity I have left is due to the fact that I do my best to practice this. In the context of trying to live according to precepts, to live according to vow, take very careful care of our mind state. It is said that when we vow to save all sentient beings, we're vowing to save them in our mind, or in our mind. Now that can sound like some sort of radical subjectivism or dismissal of commitment to the world. But no, that's not what it means. It means we need to take very careful care of our mind streams. Our mind streams are going to affect our surroundings. Our mind streams are going to affect other beings, whether we will it or not, whether we like it or not. What's happening in our hearts and minds will have an effect upon others and upon ourselves. Therefore, we need to learn to take as careful care of our mind streams as possible. This is what it means to save all sentient beings. That is the work. Deep, exquisite care of the contents of our heart and mind, moment by moment. That's all it is. And if we think, if I were to think, you know, there's various people, various beings that I'm interacting with on a daily basis. There's Elsa, who was, here's, her family was taken from her by some kind of tragic accident. I don't know if it was an automobile accident. She's on the street, talking to the voices she hears in her head. If I thought that to save sentient beings means I have to go to Elsa, I have to restore her sanity, get her housed, I would probably end up messing up her life further rather than actually helping her. The work is to take exquisite care of the contents of our heart and mind, moment by moment by moment. That's the work. And it's actually harder work, I think, I feel, than social work or social justice work, where you're providing resources and you're trying to materially help people. There's nothing wrong with materially helping people. That's good, hard work. I think the vow is harder, because we have to be so rigorously honest with ourselves. Mm-hmm. And it is of deep benefit. Cosmically. It's not just something we're doing for ourselves. It is very much not something that we're doing solely for ourselves. When we realize interdependence, when we realize how inevitably the state of our being will have its effect rippling out, and we have no way of knowing how, it's beyond our comprehension how, then we realize how vitally important saving all sentient beings in our mind stream actually is. Taking careful care of our mind stream. Hence we have precepts. The one who is not busy. When irritation arises and there's awareness of irritation arising, who is the one that notices that? When anger arises, when a samskara of judgment or prejudice arises, and there's clear seeing of that, who is the one who sees that? This question cannot be answered with any particular statement, because any particular statement would be provisional. But the point is in the seeking. The point is in the looking. Then there's so much space. There's so much space to be a monk who is distractedly sweeping the floor. No problem, no big deal. There is space for a mission director yesterday to actually scream in rage and say, I really want to destroy something now. And there's full awareness of rage. And then it's gone. Because of some knowledge of the one who is not busy. Some that the one knowledge of the one who is not busy is lubrication. It's so much more readily available, the letting go. The letting go is so much readily available. When you look for the one who is not busy, see that there's no one there, and then the kleshas just flow. They come, they go, they come, they go. not fooled. When we know the one who is not busy, when the mental state just arises and it's not me, there's no me there to defend, there's just irritation, there's just offense, then it's more easy to let go. Kind of cunning, isn't it?
Yeah.
So I think the kind of cunning we need is not to be fooled by the contents of our heart and mind, to take careful inventory. Oh, this is arising. Irritation is arising. Jealousy is arising. Mm-hmm. Anger is arising. Rage is arising. Shame is arising. But that's all. The one who is not busy is not caught because he's not there. She's not there. And we don't attribute self and other. We don't reify the event into some drama of offense and retribution. We just see suffering has arisen. I can hold this. I can observe this. I can take care of this. That is my vow, to take care of this. This is very, very important work. I think this is the kingdom of God, to have some measure of freedom, not from our karma, but in the midst of our karma. And this I think is how, knowing the one who is not busy, where we're not deceived by the contents of our heart and mind. We have a lot of spaciousness just to see it. Not judge ourselves for it, not judge others for it. Feel what is there to be felt and let it go. Very important work. I think not being able to do this, we live eye for eye, tooth for tooth. Retribution is necessary to balance the scales, and then we have a world of suffering. That's how important this work is. This is the path of peace. For all existence. Is that not the line that's in the ceremony, I think? This is the path of peace for all existence in the Jukai ceremony, I think. Something of that nature. I'm not getting it quite right. I should drink this. I went through the trouble of making. So why a ceremony? What's that all about? Why all the bells and whistles? Why the Jukai? Well, I'll start by saying, you know, once upon a time, the Buddha was seeking the Buddha to be was seeking enlightenment. And Mara, crafty old Mara, was trying various stratagems to keep him from actually attaining enlightenment. Gorgeous looking women, all kinds of things. And then, my take on the story is that Mara was really getting pissed off that he wasn't having any success. And in his rage, he lost his composure and says, "Who do you think you are? Trying to do this. This is, you're an upstart. You don't deserve to accomplish the way," something of that nature. And I like to tell myself the story that not as a stratagem, that he was kind of like frustrated and he lost his cool and was accusing the Buddha, honestly maybe, of not being worthy. And so the Buddha touched the earth to bear witness to his worthiness to sit on the Bodhimanda, the seat of enlightenment. And that dispelled Mara. Now, Jukai, taking the precepts, receiving the Bodhisattva precepts and taking the Bodhisattva vow, is akin to a marriage. I think. Two people love each other. They fall in love. They get to know one another. They have a sense that they want to journey through this life, anyway, with this person as a soulmate. To support that intention, in a Christian tradition, they present themselves before God and make a vow to each other that this is what they want to do. A person, and then God blesses their marriage, right? That's the party line anyway. In the Jukai ceremony, an individual intends to commit themselves, whole body, whole mind, to the precepts, to the Bodhisattva way. And the bells and whistles of the ceremony, the preceptor support that intention and create the psychic space to call the whole cosmos to bear witness to this intention, and calls forth the support of the whole cosmos for this individual to accomplish his vow or her vow. And celestial beings throughout the cosmos go a little berserk and start throwing flowers in celebration of the fact. So the ceremony is a way for the rest of the universe to meet the intention. And this is not just words. The various supports of the ceremony, the flowers on the altar look different in that moment. The light on the candle looks different, is different in that moment. The voice of the preceptor, one's own voice, is different. There's a different psychic space that allows this to be more than words, where there's this interaction, there's a cosmic interaction that happens. A space is opened, and the universe responds. And the celestial beings throw down flowers. That's in the ceremony. So that's what happens. Now I could say that if you really want to be of benefit to this world in your life, you need to take this ceremony. But that would be emotional blackmail.
What?
Emotional blackmail. I could say that if you feel you're unworthy of receiving the precepts, or if you feel you're afraid you won't be able to keep the precepts, you're just being lazy. But that would be emotional blackmail. Mm-hmm. It is true that if two people fall in love and get married the next day, geez, what's going to happen with that? It is true that people may not be prepared to take the vow or receive the precepts formally. And so, given that truth, the things I said before could be emotional blackmail. However, this is the path of peace for all existence. This is necessary work. In some context or another, this is the necessary work. It is hard. It requires consummate honesty with oneself. No more closets to hide in. But if we want to help the world, something of this nature has to be done. Or it's eye for eye, tooth for tooth, until the sun explodes. There are two people in silliness that are requesting Jukai. My thought right now, I described the ceremony, and to some extent I didn't go into details about the ceremony, but I described the the psychic space and the cosmic import of the ceremony. My inclination at this time is to try to schedule the Jukai during Sangha week of next season, so that the infrastructure of Tassajara can lend the necessary gravitas to the ceremony. So I don't have the resources to do it in Salinas. I don't have tantos and enos and chicos and bell and nice big bells and all of that. So it's not absolutely necessary, but I think it would be very helpful. And so if anyone feels ready to say, yes, I will, and receive these precepts and take these vows, you can come talk to me. Send me an email or something. The more the merrier, as they say. I'm not going to corner anybody and try to evangelize them, but I am, you know, offering an invitation to the kingdom. Last thing I want to say is how grateful I am that there's this place, this building, this town, because I've had a pretty hellish couple of weeks. And when I pulled into Blingus and got out of the car, I told Dan he had to find another ride back to San Francisco because I was never leaving. it's very restorative to be here. This is the kingdom of God. This is Sangha. Mm-hmm. This is folks that whether they've taken the precepts or not, whether they intend to take the precepts or not, you have already begun this work, are doing this work, I know this. I'm preaching to the choir. I'm done.
I've noticed that those 2 monks live inside of me, and mm-hmm. they're always reminding me, well, the one who's in favor of doing less is pointing out what I'm not doing, which is not doing less. So I stop.
Mm-hmm.
We come back.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, both monks have a point. And like I say, they're not trying to win one, they're not trying to defeat each other. They are not trying to defeat each other. They're trying to deepen this interplay.
Yeah.
And the two monks are within both of us, and they both do need to be honored.
Yeah, it's hard for me. I guess I'm on the side of the one who keeps stopping the other one from doing too much.
Mm-hmm.
Equanimous.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Exactly. You know, it won't do to just let the monkey mind run a monk.
Yeah.
It won't do to take a stick and beat the bleepity bleep out of the monkey either. I work with homeless people. My vocabulary can get colorful, so I need to remember what realm I'm in.
Oh, we use colorful language too.
Okay.
I particularly like what you said about the Bodhisattva vow, because I always have trouble, and particularly in the last couple of weeks, with the idea of, you know, saving all beings. And I tend to think of it as you suggested. You know, literally saving people,
mm-hmm.
literally.
Yeah.
And I know it's hopeless, you know, to try to save everybody or anybody in a way.
Mm-hmm.
And so the vow is sort of internal, aimed at one's own heart rather than. That's really important.
It's very important, but as a way of engagement, though, and it's so important. Sometimes when people hear, you save them in your own mind. That there's a sense of, oh, it doesn't really matter.
But yeah, that's always the trap. Always the trap is thinking somehow that this practice, you know, is going to get me above my need to be concerned about all of that. And it doesn't. And I'm often inclined to just say, the hell with it, let the world go the way it wants to go. And in a certain sense, you know, I mean, in a certain sense, being in Bolinas is like that, in some real ways, you know. It's so much easier to be here than to drive over the hill and have to deal with traffic and the rest of the people in the Bay Area. I mean, it really is. But it's, there is no refuge like that from the real world.
Yeah.
As you said, so I really appreciate what you said.
I've always really not wanted to be a bodhisattva. Not wanted to be here forever until all sentient beings are saved. So I just greatly appreciate your explanation, your teaching about what it means, you know, what the work really is, how it's really about mindfulness and paying attention to our own hearts and minds, every minute, every second, which is huge work, of course, but it's more manageable than thinking about being here forever, you know, on this planet, in this realm. Thank you.
The two monks talking to each other is not the negative thoughts that prey upon us.
Pardon?
The two monks discussing with each other are different from the negative thoughts that go battling inside all the time. Like one's correcting the other. Get the negative thought and then the other one comes. I just wonder if that's a similar or another
thing. I'm not quite sure.
Well, you were talking of the two monks, the precepts. I was thinking of the negative. I'm always battling the negative thought.
Yeah.
That that pushes down. Prepares. Thinks of disaster or whatever. If that has anything to do with. Well, if you take those dialogues that are happening inside and work them towards the precept.
Well, from the perspective of the one who is not busy, sweeping the ground with a busy mind is not negative. It's just sweeping the ground with a busy mind. From the perspective of the one who is not busy, lust, anger are not bad, are not evil. They're just a manifestation of mind. And so, you know, it can be worked on that way when there's struggling thoughts. You know, the one who's in is, and this just feels negative. It just feels like there's inner turmoil with no peace, no refuge. One might surmise that the one who is not busy is not yet part of that equation, and so some refuge in the midst of all that can be found by allowing the one who is not busy to be part of the mix, and then it's not so much of a caught problem. It's just energy arising. Does that help?
Yeah. Just trying to convert the thought process.
May our intention equally extend to every being and place with the true merit of Buddha's way. Shujo Muhen Seyando
possible, I vow to become it.